At 7:49 p.m., March 16, 2021, the first 911 call reached Cherokee County Dispatch. The caller's voice shook. Gunfire had torn through Young's Asian Massage on Highway 92. Within minutes, deputies were racing northbound. By the time they reached the strip mall, four people were already dead. 40 minutes later and 30 miles away, Atlanta police received two more calls. Shots fired at Gold Spa. Then another report, one block south, at Aromatherapy Spa. Patrol cars flooded Piedmont Road under flashing red and blue. The suspect was already gone, heading south on the interstate. Eight victims in less than an hour. Six were women of Asian descent. Newsrooms scrambled. Social media filled with fear, anger, disbelief. Was it hate? Misogyny? Madness? By midnight, a young man was in custody. A handgun lay on his car seat. The nation would soon learn his name and debate the meaning of his motive. Chapter 1. The day in Atlanta. Morning in Cherokee County started like any other. The air was mild, traffic steady on Highway 92. Inside Young's Asian Massage, four women began their shifts in a small, neat space beside a tattoo parlor and a smoke shop. The business had regular clients, many stopping by after work to unwind. Nothing about that Tuesday hinted at danger. At 2 in the afternoon, a young man named Robert Long left the suburban home he shared with his parents. He had been alone for most of the day. Investigators would later trace his route, a slow drive past church signs, convenience stores, and traffic cameras, all recording an ordinary face behind the wheel. By evening, he had purchased ammunition at a local shop and loaded his 9mm handgun. At 5:56 p.m., the first gunshot echoed through Young's Asian Massage. Workers in nearby stores froze. A customer sprinted outside and dialed 911, voice trembling, reporting people down. Deputies from the Cherokee County Sheriff's Office sped toward the strip mall as dispatchers logged multiple calls. When they arrived, they found four victims dead, another critically injured. The parking lot lights had just flickered on, casting a blue haze across the scene. Inside, shell casings lay scattered between massage tables and folded towels. Paramedics knelt beside the wounded, their radios crackling. Witnesses spoke through shock, describing a white male in a black t-shirt, heading toward a dark Hyundai. Deputies radioed the description to all surrounding counties. For several tense minutes, it seemed the violence might end there. Detectives cordoned off the area, pushing back reporters. Crime scene tape fluttered under the wind. The sheriff's spokesperson gave a brief statement, multiple fatalities, suspect at large. No motive yet known. But at 5:57 p.m., another call reached Atlanta police. Shots fired at Gold Spa on Piedmont Road, nearly 30 miles south. Officers from Zone 2 raced across Midtown. When they arrived, they found three women dead inside, each struck at close range. Across the street, at Aromatherapy Spa, gunfire had erupted again, another woman dead. The city entered lockdown mode. Helicopters tracked traffic along Interstate 75. Patrol cars sealed exits. Nearby businesses shut their doors. Witnesses described the same vehicle leaving both spa scenes, heading southbound. Within hours, state police and the Georgia Bureau of Investigation joined local departments. Command posts were set up in both counties. Detectives reviewed security footage, mapping a timeline that spanned less than 1 hour. At 7:45 p.m., Flock camera technology picked up the Hyundai on the interstate, its tag number linked to the Cherokee scene. Around 8:30 p.m., Crisp County deputies spotted the vehicle near Cordial, more than 150 miles from Atlanta. They initiated a controlled stop, surrounding the car with rifles drawn. The driver surrendered without resistance. Inside, officers found a semi-automatic handgun on the seat, along with cash, a laptop, and a small bag. At headquarters, investigators pieced together what had happened. They learned the suspect had been to the spas before, and that he had checked into a nearby motel days earlier. His parents had seen surveillance images released online and called the police, identifying their son. By midnight, the killings dominated national news. Reporters framed it as both a mass shooting and a potential hate crime. The victims' names were not yet public, but the details were unmistakable. Eight dead, six of them women of Asian descent. At a late-night press conference, Atlanta's police chief stood beside the mayor. They promised full cooperation with state and federal agencies. The FBI confirmed it would assist with evidence review and motive analysis. Outside, a small crowd gathered in candlelight near Piedmont Road. People wept quietly, holding flowers. Others stared at the police tape, unsure how to process what had unfolded in their own neighborhood. Back in Cherokee County, investigators worked past dawn, collecting footage from gas stations and traffic intersections. The crime scene at Young's Asian Massage remained sealed. Forensics teams bagged evidence, bullet fragments, shell casings, and fingerprints from the door handle. Detectives mapped a chillingly efficient route. The suspect left home before sunset, killed four people in Acworth, then drove to Atlanta and killed four more, all within 70 minutes. By the morning of March 17, the suspect was being transported to the Cherokee County Detention Center. He spoke briefly with officers, saying the shootings were not racially motivated. He claimed addiction, shame, and frustration, words investigators documented but did not immediately accept at face value. The news spread fast. Communities across the nation reacted in grief and disbelief. Advocates for Asian American rights began organizing vigils and rallies, while families of victims were still receiving word of their loved ones. Police agencies confirmed that coordination between counties had been rapid, crediting license plate cameras and early public identification for the swift arrest. But questions loomed over how a young man with no prior violent record could carry out such an attack so easily. By evening, the candlelight vigils had grown. People held signs reading "Stop Asian Hate" and "Protect Our Sisters." The faces of the victims began to appear online, each name bringing the tragedy closer to home. Investigators reviewed the suspect's digital trail, old church videos, deleted social media accounts, web searches tied to addiction and guilt. The FBI Behavioral Analysis Unit prepared to consult. Atlanta's skyline glowed blue and white that night. In the streets below, patrol cars still guarded the spas. Reporters filed their stories from behind barricades, careful not to show bodies or blood. The city was silent except for the sound of camera shutters and the low hum of police generators. The story had only begun to unfold. Chapter 2. Who they were and why it happened. Morning light spilled over downtown Atlanta. Reporters gathered outside police headquarters. Their microphones pointed toward the entrance where detectives moved quietly in and out. Overnight, the suspect had been charged with 8 counts of murder. The names of the victims were released just after sunrise. They were women and men with families, stories, and reasons for being in those spas that day. Hyun-Yung Grant, a 41-year-old single mother who loved to dance and cared for 2 sons. Soon-Chung Park, age 74, who still worked long hours to help her family. Sun-Cha Kim, 69, a grandmother known for her warmth. Yong Aeyu, 63, who had immigrated years earlier in search of peace and stability. Xiao Jia Tan, the owner of Young's Asian Massage, 59, described as disciplined, kind, and proud of her small business. Daoyu Fong, 44, had only recently joined the staff. 2 others, Delana Yan and Paul Andre Michaels, were customers that night, both killed in Acworth. The official list humanized what had been a series of crime scenes on the map. Within hours, photos and brief tributes spread across television and social media. Families spoke from homes in Georgia, New York, and beyond, still unable to comprehend the loss. Investigators from both counties continued working side by side with FBI agents. They examined security footage from all 3 spa locations. Each camera showed the same man walking in calmly, head slightly down, gun in hand. There was no shouting, no warning. The attacks lasted only minutes. At headquarters, detectives listened to the suspect's interviews. He spoke in a quiet, almost detached tone. He described addiction to sex, guilt, and the belief that the spas represented temptation. He said he wanted to eliminate that temptation. Officers pressed him on motive, whether the attacks targeted Asian women specifically. He denied it. Federal agents kept their questions measured, noting that 6 of the 8 victims were Asian women and that the spas were chosen deliberately. The public heard a different tone from the sheriff's first press conference that afternoon. A spokesperson described the shooter as having a really bad day. The phrase landed hard. Within minutes, outrage erupted online and in Atlanta's Asian American community. Critics said the comment humanized the killer while minimizing the victims. Civil rights groups demanded a hate crime investigation. By that night, candlelight vigils had begun across several cities: Atlanta, New York, Seattle, San Francisco. Signs read, "We belong here," and "Stop Asian Hate." Community leaders spoke about years of harassment, slurs, and fear that had grown worse during the pandemic. The shootings felt like the worst possible proof of what many had warned was coming. Meanwhile, reporters dug into the suspect's past. He was 21, raised in a strict Baptist household in Cherokee County. Friends described him as quiet, isolated, and deeply religious. Former church members said he struggled with guilt over sexual behavior and spent months in recovery programs. His family issued a statement expressing shock and sorrow, apologizing to the victim's relatives. The spa worker's world came under sudden scrutiny. Some of the businesses had long been targets of suspicion: coded online reviews, late-night clientele, whispered assumptions. Advocates urged people not to conflate rumor with fact. The women who worked there, they said, often supported entire families and faced stigma from outsiders. Journalists pieced together a picture of cultural invisibility: women who cleaned, comforted, and worked quietly in storefronts people drove past every day. Interviews with customers described normal massage sessions, not the fantasy narratives that had circulated online. Federal prosecutors began reviewing evidence for potential hate crime charges. Georgia had only recently passed its hate crime statute in 2020, after the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. Investigators weighed intent, statements, and pattern. They studied whether the killings were rooted in racial bias, misogyny, or both. As the case deepened, so did the conversation. Asian American advocates appeared on national broadcasts, pointing to centuries of hypersexualization of Asian women and the overlapping patterns of race, gender, and violence. Religious commentators discussed moral extremism and purity culture. Psychologists debated the role of shame, isolation, and distorted belief. For the families, the debate offered little comfort. Funeral arrangements were made in multiple languages. At one service, a pastor read the names slowly, pausing after each. In another, a son spoke through tears, thanking strangers for standing beside them. The suspect remained in custody without bond. His statements were recorded, but not yet presented in court. Prosecutors moved carefully, aware that motive would shape not only the legal case, but the national conversation. By April, murals appeared across Atlanta: flowers, candles, portraits. At Piedmont Park, volunteers hung paper cranes from trees. Messages written in both English and Korean read, "We will not forget." The investigation stretched into months. Search warrants covered the suspect's phone, computer, and online history. Investigators found maps of spa locations and notes about addiction recovery, confirming premeditation. They documented his purchases, a handgun bought just hours before the attacks. Public reaction split along lines of empathy and anger. Some faith leaders focused on mental health and guilt. Others said the case revealed a broader sickness: how racism and misogyny intersect quietly until they explode. By the end of summer, prosecutors in Cherokee and Fulton counties had prepared separate indictments. The Cherokee indictment covered the first four victims, the Fulton case the remaining four. The Fulton district attorney announced she would pursue the death penalty and seek hate crime enhancements. In court documents, prosecutors described the killings as deliberate, planned, and driven by bias against women of Asian descent. Defense attorneys hinted at a plea strategy that might avoid execution. The proceedings were methodical, each motion weighed carefully under public scrutiny. Outside the courthouses, vigils continued. People brought flowers and photos of the victims. News crews returned every few weeks, filming updates. The story had become both legal record and cultural mirror. What had started as a police manhunt was now a national reckoning. The central question remained: was this about race, sex, or both? Investigators had facts, but meaning was harder to define. The survivors, the families, and the community wanted more than a conviction, they wanted acknowledgement. Inside the detective units, the work never slowed. Analysts prepared evidence chains for both trials. FBI specialists traced the handgun's purchase and confirmed the background check had cleared legally. That fact unsettled many: a gun bought in the morning, eight people dead by evening. In late 2022, pretrial motions filled court calendars. The victims' relatives testified about loss, identity, and the sense that their mothers and sisters had been erased twice: once by the killer, again by the public's assumptions. Through it all, the city of Atlanta carried a quiet unease. Storefronts reopened, the yellow tape long gone, but the memory lingered. Some of the spas never resumed business. Others changed names, hoping for peace. By early 2023, the Cherokee County Court accepted a guilty plea. the judge imposed life without parole. The Fulton County case, still pending, carried the potential death penalty. In the courtroom, relatives sat in silence as the sentence was read. A translator whispered each word in Korean. There was no sense of triumph, only finality. The man at the defense table said little. Outside, cameras flashed again. Reporters repeated the timeline. One man, eight victims, 70 minutes. But the deeper timeline, years of stereotypes, quiet fears, and ignored warnings, stretched far longer. When night fell, candles returned to the steps of the Capitol. People stood together, heads bowed. Some prayed. Others simply watched the lights flicker against the marble. The question lingered, could this tragedy shift anything lasting? Chapter 3. Justice, Memory, and Change. The courtroom in downtown Atlanta was silent, except for the hum of air vents and the shuffling of papers. It was July 2023 when prosecutors in Fulton County announced their intention to seek the death penalty. The decision was not made lightly. The district attorney said the killings were heinous, targeted, and calculated, citing the pattern of victims and the motive described as moral cleansing. Families of the victims sat in the gallery, holding framed photographs. Some had traveled across states to be present. Translators whispered testimony line by line in Korean and Mandarin. The weight of the trial felt both local and national. This was not just about a single man or a single night. It was about a pattern too many had ignored. Across Georgia, communities watched closely. The state had rarely used its hate crime statute in conjunction with a death penalty case. Civil rights lawyers argued the prosecution's strategy could set precedent. Defense attorneys countered that the suspect's claim of addiction and guilt, however twisted, did not fit the legal definition of racial bias. Outside, rows of candles and flowers lined the courthouse steps. Activists held banners for the victims, some reading Protect Asian Women, others End Gendered Hate. The vigils had become a form of ritual, bridging grief and activism. Each year since the shootings, Atlanta marked March 16 with memorial events. In interviews, survivors and families described small details that stayed with them. A phone that kept ringing after the news broke, an unfinished meal on a table, the last text that went unanswered. For them, justice was not measured in years or verdicts. It was the acknowledgement that their loved ones mattered beyond headlines. Journalists revisited the story often, tracing how the phrase "Stop Asian Hate" had grown from protest signs into community programs, educational campaigns, and local grants for safety and language access. What began as outrage became infrastructure, neighborhood watches, cultural centers, scholarships in the victims' names. At Young's Asian Massage, the storefront remained closed. A small plaque by the entrance carried the eight names. Visitors left flowers and handwritten notes. One read, "We will remember you as mothers, daughters, and workers, not as a headline." Inside law enforcement agencies, the case spurred reviews of how multiple shootings are communicated across jurisdictions. The quick cooperation between Cherokee County and Atlanta Police became a training example for future crises. Commanders emphasized how license plate cameras and real-time coordination shortened the manhunt to less than 3 hours. But technology could not fix the deeper questions: why the warning signs had gone unnoticed. In church circles, former peers of the shooter debated the culture that had shaped him. Sermons and op-eds discussed guilt, repression, and the danger of mixing shame with access to weapons. Mental health professionals used the case to highlight the lack of early intervention programs for young men isolated by fear and obsession. The broader Asian American community saw something larger: how violence against women of color could be rationalized under the language of purity, how the system too often sought excuses before empathy. The spa workers had lived on the margins, visible enough to serve, invisible when harmed. Their deaths made that invisibility impossible to ignore. As the months turned into years, trials and appeals continued. The suspect remained behind bars under high security. Federal agencies closed their parallel review, affirming the state's findings. The shootings were premeditated, the selection of targets deliberate. Meanwhile, families continued to gather each March. At the first anniversary, a crowd filled Piedmont Park. Lanterns floated into the night sky, each bearing a name written in both English and Korean. Speakers took turns reading short memories, a favorite song, a mother's recipe, a friend's laughter. The event ended with silence, the kind that settles when words are not enough. The movement that followed reshaped conversations beyond Georgia. Universities began teaching case studies on media framing, exploring how early reports often focused more on the killer's motives than on the victims' lives. Lawmakers in several states introduced bills strengthening hate crime penalties and funding victim support programs. By 2024, Atlanta police had instituted new cultural competency training for officers. Dispatchers learned basic Korean and Mandarin phrases to improve emergency response in immigrant neighborhoods. Churches partnered with advocacy groups to host listening sessions, bridging communities that had rarely spoken to each other before the tragedy. Still, the pain did not vanish. For many, justice could not undo the loss or erase the sense of vulnerability it exposed. One survivor, speaking at a university forum, said, "We live between fear and resilience. Justice is not an endpoint, it's a reminder to stay awake." In the years since, the spas themselves became memorial ground. Gold Spa, once a neon-lit storefront on Piedmont Road, was repainted white and closed permanently. Aromatherapy Spa reopened under a new name, owned by a relative of one of the victims. The walls inside held quiet photographs, not for customers, but for memory. Each name carved into the memorial carried its own legacy. Hyun-Yung Grant's sons received scholarships from donations that poured in after her death. They spoke publicly about her love for music and the long nights she worked to provide for them. Yong AEU's family established a fund supporting immigrant women entrepreneurs. The legacy of March 16, 2021, became less about the crime itself and more about the response. How people turned pain into policy, grief into visibility. The case continued to appear in documentaries, classrooms, and legislative debates. When the Fulton County Court reconvened for final sentencing, few cameras remained. The nation had moved on to other crises. Yet in that quiet courtroom, the weight of the story returned. The defendant stood as the judge read the sentence. Life imprisonment without parole. No death penalty, no appeal for sympathy. Just the certainty of consequence. Outside, the families walked into the sun. Some cried, others said nothing. Reporters asked for comments, but most declined. They had said what mattered long ago, that their loved ones were more than victims. That evening, a vigil once again lit up Piedmont Road. Candles flickered under a warm wind. A pastor spoke softly. Hate feeds on silence. We honor them by speaking their names. One by one, the names were read aloud. The crowd repeated each in chorus, a steady rhythm of remembrance. In the distance, the city moved on, cars, lights, laughter. But for those gathered, the sound of those names was enough to hold the night still. Atlanta would never forget what happened on March 16. The lives taken in less than an hour had reshaped how a city and a country saw itself. The cost was unbearable. The legacy, undeniable.